This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. 851,229. That's the number of veterans waiting for their disability benefits from the Department of Veterans Affairs as of June 8th. Of those, more than 500,000 have been waiting for more than 125 days. That means they're officially backlogged. The VA backlog has grown exponentially over the last few years. According to internal VA documents obtained by the Center for Investigative Reporting, the number of veterans waiting for more than a year has grown by more than 2,000% in just 4 years. The system is so backlogged that the weight of the paper files at the Winston-Salem VA began to buckle the floor, something Jon Stewart had great fun with on The Daily Show.
There's still a backlog of claims for 900,000 veterans and paper disability records still undigitized and piled up so high that the floor of one VA field office is going to collapse. Perhaps injuring people who luckily would at least have instant access to the proper forms they would need.
No laughing matter to North Carolina Senator Kay Hagan. She's been pushing the Obama administration to do something about the backlog. I spoke with her earlier this month, and she said that what concerned her was that the average wait times are actually going up.
On average, the claims office in Winston-Salem, 365 days they take to process a claim. That is literally back in September, it was 329. And what concerns me greatly about this is over the year, it's grown by over the last 4 years, these claims pending have grown over 2,000% despite a 40% increase in the VA's budget. During the same period, Congress has given the VA everything that it has asked for in terms of more funding and more employees, but it hasn't eliminated this background. I sent a letter to General Shinseki, Secretary of the VA, and I did hear back, and I'm glad in his response, he did say that they were hiring an additional 25 claims employees have been hired to assist in the backlog in the Winston-Salem Regional Office.
Well, it sounds like things are getting worse, though, and we sent him a letter. That's nice. But, I mean, if some's good, more is better. Is anything? What else has to happen here? It doesn't sound like 25 more employees going to solve the problem.
Frank, that's what my concern is. I don't know if that's enough to eradicate the backlog. I requested they send senior staff, that they really look at this issue and try to figure out a way on timelines on how they're going to solve this problem.
Do you have any ideas what he might find or what he might suggest to actually solve this problem? It sounds like it's more than just people and money because, as you said, they've got that. Has anybody given you advice about how you might get a handle on this backlog?
Well, that's what we're asking them to do, you know. Send senior staff, send a group that really can analyze the issue, analyze the situation, and then come up with what it's going to take, how long it's going to take, what the parameters of that will be, so we can have a plan to go forward.
Well, a few days after that conversation with Senator Hagan, VA Secretary Eric Shinseki did indeed agree to send a senior staffer to the Winston-Salem office. He was asked about the backlog during a visit to UNC Chapel Hill last week.
We have been on combat operations for 12 years now, and so there's been a growth in requirement. Paper processes aren't very efficient. I think all of us would agree with that. And there's been a growth in the complexity of the injuries because of the quality of medical care we provide. So all of that said, we need a new way of approaching this requirement to be efficient in processing claims. For the last 2 years, we've developed and have been fielding an automation system called the Veterans Benefits Management System, and that will replace that stack of paper that you saw. But this is a crossover year. So we're in paper, coming out of paper. We have begun fielding Veterans Benefits Management System. We gave ourselves 2013 to complete the fielding. We're ahead of schedule, I'm happy to say. And here in the next year or so, we'll watch the backlog just begin to be taken down. 2015 still remains our target date. If we can beat it, we will.
VA Secretary Eric Shinseki last week in Chapel Hill. I'm joined now by Jason Hansman, Senior Program Manager for Health Programs at Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. IAVA is a nonpartisan advocacy organization that's been at the forefront of the campaign to reduce the claims backlog. Welcome, Jason.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
What's your response to Secretary Shinseki's comments?
You know, I think, you know, they're doing all that they can, but I think they're a couple of years late on this. I think the Secretary is absolutely right that they need a new way of doing things, that, you know, the paper system isn't what they need right now, but this is 2013. We should have had an automated, a computerized system years ago.
Do you have much confidence that they're going to be able to get this done by 2015?
Yeah, I think they will. I think from what we're hearing is they're rolling this out while it is slowly. I think they will meet their 2015 target date, but 2015 is a long time from now, especially when you have vets that are waiting for issues like PTSD, traumatic brain injury, physical injuries as well, and they're waiting on this disability check. They don't need just another, you know, date in the future. They need relief now.
Well, tell us what that means. I mean, give us what does it mean in particular? Maybe you can tell us stories of particular veterans, what that means to wait for these benefits.
You know, for some vets, you know, what this disability backlog is, this is a pension check. And for a lot of vets, it's going to be a pension check for the rest of their lives. So if you are 100% disabled, meaning that you cannot work, you cannot function as you did before you entered into the military, this is their livelihood. This is people that are going to be missing rent. This is people that are potentially going to be adding into this homelessness number, or worst case, taking their own lives because they have not gotten the relief and they have not gotten these claims done by the VA.
I have to assume that there has been a backlog after every war, but this, we're seeing a 2,000% increase in 4 years. Is there something in particular about what's happening now that makes things worse? What's going on?
You know, part of this is the VA's own doing in expanding eligibility requirements for Agent Orange for Vietnam vets, which is exactly the thing that they should have done. That being said, they should have planned a little better for it going into it, because a lot of these vets aren't Iraq and Afghanistan vets at all. It's only about 20% of this backlog number. A lot of these are Vietnam vets, Korean War vets that are waiting for their claims as well. And this Agent Orange presumptive illness is what they call it in the VA. Expanding that to Agent Orange and the associated diseases and cancers and whatnot was the right thing to do, but it set them behind and added a bunch of claims to the backlog, which kind of put us in this situation right now.
It's interesting, only 20%, and yet we would think that perhaps the duration of these conflicts and the fact that more veterans are surviving wounds that in years past would have been fatal, how big a part is that playing in this, or is it?
You know, the Secretary talked about, you know, these claims are more complex. I think goes straight to what you're saying about a lot of vets that are surviving injuries that they wouldn't have in previous conflicts. Instead of filing for maybe one or two disabilities, they're applying for six, seven, or eight disabilities, which is another stress on the system, especially when you're trying to do it all on paper, trying to corral all these medical records and all this proof of all these disabilities. I mean, it's only going to, I mean, that only makes the situation worse.
You know, it's ironic in some ways because the VA's medical system is, in fact, a model medical system. The private industry is looking at the government medical program. Here, socialized medicine apparently is the model in the United States for its efficiency in handling records. And yet the idea of matching these disability claims with DOD's database seems to be almost impossible for them.
You're right. You were talking about three very different and three very separate systems. You have the DOD medical records, you have the VA medical records, and then you have the VA benefit records. And they're three different systems, and none of them talk to each other. So you're basically shooting in the dark, each one of them.
Give us a sense of what IAVA is pushing for. What would you like to see change?
You know, since this is such a complex issue, it spans at least two agencies, many more, we're asking for the president to take some real leadership here and get us all on track. Get us on track to get a unified system between the VA and the DOD, or at least one that talks to each other, and really take leadership on this backlog issue and make sure that vets are not waiting over that 125 days.
So is that really all it takes? I mean, just getting these records digitized, it sounds like that's kind of the key to this whole process.
It is. And, you know, we have vets that have lost, that have had their medical records lost, or they've had their claims lost for a number of years. So you have, you know, if they're on the internet, or if they're not on the internet, but if they're, you know, digital, that issue is not going to be there anymore. They're going to be able to find them and process them quicker, which is, I think, the key here.
Well, you apparently have not seen our male client here at WUNC, but I take your point. It's a lot easier to track. Jason Hansman is Senior Program Manager for Health Programs at Iraq, Afghanistan Veterans for America. We're going to take a break. We're going to bring you back and talk more, but we're going to change the subject a little bit and talk about the other more expanded needs for our returning veterans when our conversation on the State of Things continues. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When the suspect in a shooting rampage last month in Texas was identified as a Marine from Camp Lejeune, many people made a leap that's become all too familiar. Lance Corporal Esteban Smith was a veteran of two tours in Afghanistan. So the rush to judgment. He must have been damaged by that experience. He must have snapped as a result. Well, the truth is we know very little about the circumstances of Smith's alleged crimes. Indeed, we know less than we think we do about the connections between combat, post-traumatic stress disorder, returning veterans, and acts of violence. Eric Elbegin is teasing out some of those complex connections through a national survey of Iraq and Afghan veterans, and is an associate professor of psychiatry at UNC Chapel Hill. He does clinical work at the Durham VA Medical Center, and he joins us now, along with Pete Tillman, who's public affairs officer with the Durham VA. And still on the line with us, Jason Hansman, senior program manager for health programs at Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. So welcome to all of you. Thanks for being on the show here.
Thanks for having us.
Eric Elbegin, tell us, first of all, post-traumatic stress disorder. We sort of need a definition again to keep us thinking straight about this.
Post-traumatic stress disorder involves first a traumatic experience where someone's life was threatened. There's a perception of that. Or there actually was a threat. And then there are clusters of symptoms, the first being re-experiencing symptoms where one might have flashbacks. Second would be avoidance symptoms, where people try to avoid places or people or things that remind them of the event. And the third are what are called hyperarousal symptoms, which involve anger or irritability or other types of physiological or emotional responses to the trauma.
And we associate this certainly with difficulty reentering society and engaging in normal and productive ways. Is there a close correlation between PTSD and an inability to get a job and get back to a normal lifestyle?
Our research has looked at the link between PTSD and aggressiveness and criminal justice, which are criminal justice involvement, both of which would be seen as difficulties getting back into society. And what we've found is that the relationship between the two is very complex. And we've surveyed veterans across the country and found that the vast majority of veterans with PTSD are not violent, are not aggressive, and do not get arrested.
There are other factors that are involved, and apparently that's when PTSD is a factor, but not necessarily the determining factor. What are these other factors?
What we found was that it is the case that veterans with PTSD have slightly higher rates of violence, but it's largely attributable to alcohol misuse. And also, there are a lot of non-PTSD factors that have little to do with combat exposure that relate to whether or not a veteran's going to have difficulty readjusting to the community.
And what are those factors?
Some of them include younger age, being unemployed, having a history of violence or criminal arrest even before they were in the military. And just like civilians, alcohol misuse and substance abuse increase risk.
Pete Tillman, what do we know about these difficulties in readjustment? It may be a hard thing to get a handle on, but what do we know about reintegration?
Well, what we know is it's certainly not easy, and it's not easy to do it alone or go at it alone. Durham VA Medical Center has the privilege to treat 60,000 unique patients. That's a 5% increase in unique patients over last year. And So what we've seen is an increase in need for our services. And, you know, we're proud of the care we deliver. So we want to make sure that veterans that not just come back and return from service of the generation now, but really all previous conflicts, know that there's benefits and services available to them. VA stands ready, willing, and able with open arms to provide high-quality care to those veterans. And really, we want them to know that.
Jason, what do you know about the likelihood that people coming back, let's just say from Iraq and Afghanistan, because that's your focus, what are some of the difficulties in reintegrating? And are we seeing a higher percentage of people coming back not able to integrate, falling into homelessness, for instance?
Yeah, you know, I think reintegration is difficult. I had to go through it myself when I came back in 2004 or 2005. I think some of the biggest issues are employment, going back into school, for instance, or, you know, just readjusting to your family life as well. And I think we do see some people, unfortunately, falling into homelessness amongst this generation, which is an absolute shame. I think, you know, services such as the VA, there's hundreds of others, thousands of other veteran service organizations out there that are standing, you know, ready to help veterans and their families to kind of readjust to civilian life. But it's difficult, and, you know, for any vet out there, you know, you should reach out. Reach out and make sure that you're, you know, doing what you can to make sure that that readjustment, you know, you're not doing that alone.
Dr. Elbegin?
One of the surprising things we found from our study, I think there's a perception among veterans and military families about potentially what are called perceived barriers to care. There's a stigma perceived that, oh, I don't want to get help. But we actually found, I think this is important, that 70% of the veterans in our national study who were diagnosed with PTSD had actually accessed care in the last year. That's much higher than civilians, which means that veterans with PTSD are showing a lot more courage than a lot of civilians do to getting care. And I think if someone's ambivalent, a veteran is ambivalent about getting care, it would be good for them to know that there are other the other veterans,
They're doing it.
Yeah.
And so to some extent, this stigma that we thought was in place and was a profound barrier seems to have been lifted. 70%, as you say, are accessing the care they need. But your research also suggests that they need more services than that. What are the other services that can help veterans, particularly those with PTSD, help them reintegrate?
Like you were saying before, there are other factors, and we've looked at aggression. And what we found actually is that veterans who weren't meeting their basic needs were more likely to be aggressive than veterans with PTSD. And the VA has homelessness services, they have vocational services, financial money management services, a lot of services to help veterans get those protective factors they need to reduce their risks.
So you're saying there's a greater likelihood that a vet in poverty is going to commit an act of violence than a vet with PTSD, that's a much more important factor.
That's what we found.
Wow. So, Jason, let me ask you about that. In terms of social networking and some of the other services, what else is available and what's being done to help relieve poverty?
You know, there's a bunch of employment programs out there. I mean, the VA does a ton of job fairs across the country to make sure that vets are connected to resources and to jobs, and I think that's key. We run a program here in New York City that's a pilot program through the Robin Hood Foundation that connects vets with resources very generally. So if a vet is homeless, if a vet doesn't have a job, if a vet is falling into poverty, we help them one-on-one through case managers to make sure that they get connected to the resources that they need to be connected to. I think it's that one-on-one with vets that needs to happen a lot of times to, you know, make them feel that they're not alone anymore. And certainly peer-to-peer support as well. There's a bunch of online programs that vets can participate in. Vets Prevail, IAVA's own community of veterans, to help vets realize that they're not the only ones that are going through this.
And I would think that just their age going in, Jason, I'll stick with you for a minute. I mean, these are young people going into the service in a situation, in a context where everything is being taken care of for them. And then they come out and suddenly sort of find themselves into an adult world that their peers had to contend with maybe, several years earlier. How much of a factor is that in reintegrating?
Yeah, I think there's certainly this sense of being overwhelmed when you get out of the military. I think you got it right. You know, when I was in the military, my clothes every day were already decided for me. I didn't have to figure out, what I was going to wear that day. I didn't have to advocate for a job, which is essentially what a resume and an interview are. I got everything basically handed to me every moment of the day when I was in the military, and having to kind of come back and decide, every little thing and do things that we take for granted, like resumes, interviews, or searching for an apartment, that can be overwhelming for some vets.
Eric Ulbigen, I would think the other thing is that in general, younger men are more at risk for almost everything because of their behavior. So that's the population that we're working with. I mean, isn't that partly true?
We found that age was a stronger predictor of aggression than PTSD or combat exposure. So, yes, demographics need to be considered. PTSD is associated with higher risk, but there are all these other factors like age. Male veterans were much more likely to get arrested. So demographics are much stronger statistically in terms of those outcomes.
It's interesting. So economic indicators, age, much more important in many ways than PTSD. And yet PTSD has to then complicate the solutions when you're trying to get an individual out of that case, out of that situation.
Certainly. And an example is alcohol misuse. There is a higher rate of alcohol misuse among veterans with PTSD, and it's the combination of those two that's particularly at risk.
Pete, as I said in the last segment, the VA is actually exemplary in its record keeping. The VA medical system and private care is looking to the VA as a way to streamline its own record keeping and medical care. So first of all, may I say three cheers for socialized medicine. It's working, at least in that regard. Does that mean that you can also provide – so when that's talking about medical care. I can keep track of my patients. I can keep track of their care and their caregivers, their medicine and all that. As I say, exemplary. Does that mean you can also keep track of this other array of social networks and needs, or is that sort of outside of the medical system's purview?
No, I think anything that impacts the patient care, or as we say, veteran-centric care. So we know veterans are different kinds of patients, come through our doors with different kinds of issues than traditional civilian patients. But I think Jason brought up a good point. I think all of this starts with outreach and getting them through one door, and that could be their local VA medical center. And then connecting them with a myriad of benefits and services they might be entitled to. For instance, a case manager from a recently discharged Afghanistan veteran might walk through our door on Monday. By Tuesday, they have information in their hand about the GI Bill, about the home loan assistance program. They might have already had paperwork started for Voc Rehab. And any number of benefits and services are going to come their way. So it's really important to engage them and not have a period of time go by from when they discharge in service to when they come see us to get help. And, I think it's worth saying that no one agency is going to be able to do this alone. It's a partnership with those community agencies, those veteran service organizations, in conjunction with the VA and the family members who know these veterans best when they come back and know what they may need and when they may need help.
Jason, it sounds like there are a lot of services out there, and there are some ways to get veterans connected, at least to tell them what's available. What are some of the barriers once a veteran has gone in and actually learned? You take Pete's example here, that a day later I can have a list of services that are appropriate for me. What are some of the barriers to actually accessing those and getting them to work for you?
There's certainly, with any program, especially any government program, there's a level of bureaucracy that can be a barrier. I think one of the biggest barriers, taking one step back, is there are over 40,000 organizations right now that are serving veterans nationwide. That alone is a barrier to actually finding the program and what you need. But, beyond that, I think you're talking about time, energy, I mean, anything that, you know, would keep a normal person away from services and programs.
It can be overwhelming. I can understand. Well, let me get back to our initial premise, this rush to judgment, that when a veteran, when we know that they were a combat veteran in particular, and then there's an act of violence, we connect the dots. And I wonder what effect that has on the veterans community when these stories, you know, when we tell these stories in the media, what does that narrative do?
Well, there's a knee-jerk reaction, like you said, Rick, that this has got to be PTSD. It's got to be that they were deployed. And what that does is if the community doesn't take a next step and think about, well, what else might be going on? Veterans could be stigmatized, employers, which is paradoxical since it's actually when a veteran is employed that they're not at risk.
Yeah.
So the stereotype, I think, is a real danger of that knee-jerk reaction.
Have you experienced that? What do you hear in the veterans community, Jason?
Yeah, you know, from what I hear is, you know, veterans don't like to hear the rush to judgment. I feel like it's not even when veterans are the ones that actually are committing these events, but even when it's not, we see people rush to judgment that maybe this person was a vet. And I think that's very discouraging to vets, especially well-adjusted vets or people that, you know, are having a hard time. I think that is, you know, one barrier to care as well when you're talking about, you know, vets that may not want to be labeled as someone that is crazy. And when you have that perception come up again and again in the media, that's discouraging. It's discouraging to me as a veteran who's well-adjusted and knowing that the vast majority of vets don't do that, are well-adjusted, come back into their communities, get a job and live out their lives and are great contributor to community.
Jason, let me stick with you and ask if you think the very small percentage of Americans now serving in the armed forces makes it more difficult. This war is sort of always with us and yet not with us enough. In many ways, are veterans invisible, and does that affect reintegration?
I think it does. I think, you know, you're talking about less than one half of 1% that has served in Iraq or Afghanistan. It's very easy for me to walk the streets and find someone that has never met a vet or that I'm the only vet that they know. That's tough. That creates the civil-military divide that we've heard so much about and kind of hurts, you know, vets on their readjustment process when no one or they feel that no one understands them. And I think, you know, it takes a whole community to kind of understand these issues and understand them intelligently and not kind of rush to judgment and rush to stigmatize vets around, you know, the big news stories that people hear about.
Eric, give us a sense of what you hope to do with the research that you've been pulling together.
What we're hoping for is that we're able to address PTSD as a risk factor, but also to think about other things and to think about helping someone with their financial literacy or reducing homelessness or getting a job or improving social support and resilience, even physical health, to expand and have a more rehabilitation focus on helping veterans build up protective factors to reduce their risks once they return home.
Pete, the Durham VA has been expanding, I think, to include larger networks and other groups so that these kinds of priorities can be met. Is that right?
Absolutely. We are doing that. We are expanding. We are physically expanding to meet the need and increase in services. Good example of that is Greenville, North Carolina. Early 2014, we'll be opening a 116,000 square foot specialty clinic out there called the Healthcare Center. And
let me just interrupt you there because that suggests, too, that one of the things we haven't talked about is what happens in rural areas. VA hospitals tend to be in urban areas, which means the vet has to come to you.
Absolutely. So that's two hours away at Greenville. Morehead City, which is one of the 26 counties in the area of 26 counties we serve, 4 hours away for specialty care. So we are building care sites closer to where veterans live, and we're changing our approach and how we engage them. So, for instance, you know, you used to say, are you a veteran? Come get your care at the VA. We've changed that approach and say, have you served in the military? This idea that a veteran has to be a service-connected disability or has to have some physical debilitation in order to be eligible, we're trying to dispel that myth, and we've kind of talked about this disconnect between perception and reality, and the perception that VA does not provide safe, high-quality care. And the reality is we do, and oftentimes better than the private sector. And furthermore, we understand our population of patients a lot better.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Pete Tillman is Public Affairs Officer for the Durham VA. Eric Elbigen is an Associate Professor of Psychiatry at UNC Chapel Hill. Jason Hansman is the Senior Program Manager for Health Programs at Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, empowering young women through music. We'll talk girls rock NC. Stay tuned.